Coming up on Weekend America.
Rod Blagojevich brazenly auctions off a Senate seat, bullies a newspaper, shakes down a children's hospital. How did a guy like that get elected governor of Illinois? Twice. I'm John Moe. This hour we get the latest on that mess, plus how it came to be such a mess. Also, Sarah left the game hunting culture of Wisconsin behind. Kind of.
One morning, it's in Manhattan, and one day we walk by and they said, we have venison today. Everyone was ordering it, and I was like, you know, where I'm from, that means the owner of the bar hit a deer this morning.
This hour, she revisits her roots, armed. And you know that spacey little piano-sounding instrument in the Nutcracker? It has a name, the celesta.
You know, we probably won't be hearing Metallica using celesta anytime soon. It's not really a power instrument.
We learn what a celesta is and what it isn't on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. It's been cold here this week. It's in the 30s today, but 0 degrees yesterday. No degrees at all when I walked into work, which made me ask a couple of questions. One, why am I walking into work in 0 degrees? Two, why do so many people around here seem giddy that we finally hit zero? And will they get giddier if we reach 20 below? Other questions addressed this hour. Are newspapers really dying? What's that trippy piano instrument sound in the Nutcracker? And can you reconnect with your late father through deer hunting? Here's one more. What are you doing this weekend?
Hopefully, I'm catching a plane down to Seattle and then up to Friday Harbor.
This weekend, I'm going to be making really good espresso drinks at the Oakland and San Francisco ferry markets.
I'm going to go down and visit some girlfriends and celebrate my new engagement.
I'm going to be a soccer mom in the morning, a gymnastics mom in the afternoon on Saturday. I'm going to work out.
Saturday, I'm going to a champagne tasting, and then I'm actually going to be going to Blue Bottle Coffee with my friend Nikki on Sunday. And they've got these really fancy new coffee makers from Japan, so we're having fancy coffee.
Now, if she could just find a way to combine the champagne and the coffee. That's a real interesting weekend. Those voices came from Fairbanks, Alaska, San Francisco, and Chicago. Well, speaking of Chicago, in Illinois, heads are kind of spinning. It's been a crazy week. Early Tuesday, Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich was led away in handcuffs by federal authorities. All sorts of charges against him, most notably auctioning off the vacant U.S. Senate seat, also shaking down a children's hospital. Just 6 weeks ago, when Barack Obama was elected president, it was a great time for Chicagoans. They turned out by the thousands in Grant Park to cheer. The weekend after the election, we checked in with Chicago Public Radio's political reporter Ben Calhoun. Seems like we might need to check in with him again. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you, John?
What's the deal? Illinois just loves the attention lately.
We are the center of the universe, it seems like.
So where we've heard a lot about Blagojevich this week. Where did he come from? How did this guy rise to the position that he got to?
Well, just in terms of resume, he went through the state legislature and then he became a congressman. Actually, it was a seat that Rahm Emanuel holds now until he goes off to Washington. But more importantly, Blagojevich came up through Chicago politics. His father-in-law is a Chicago alderman named Dick Mell, who's been a longtime alderman. And at least here in Chicago, that's one of the things that's most shocking about these allegations, because the alleged behavior is so brazen. And Dick Mell is the kind of guy who, you know, I've essentially heard conversations Dick Mell has had. This is Blagojevich's father-in-law, where he said, you know, you don't do email and you don't have phone conversations because those things will get you arrested. You know, and so that sort of, you know, Chicago edge, you know, is sort of that brought Blagojevich up in the political world. And so to see these allegations, people are sort of bewildered at you know, his Chicago schooling not being reflected in that.
So he gets elected twice, and then we see the fall from grace this week, rather dramatic fall from grace. What's the status today, this weekend, of the efforts to impeach him? Is he going to be holding on to his seat for a while or not?
Well, he's got two routes he can go. It's sort of – it's like a cowboy movie where everybody's circled around him and they've said, you know, you can go willingly or you can go unwillingly.
We've got a rope.
He doesn't look like he's going to go willingly. In that case, there's impeachment and then there's something that came up late last week with the attorney general. In terms of impeachment proceedings, the state legislators are meeting next week and they might take it up. They've said that they'll address the question. The attorney general thing is interesting because it would be more swift. And essentially what she wants to do is appeal to the Supreme Court and have them rule on his ability to serve. It's this obscure rule. It's called Rule 382. Sounds obscure, right?
Yes. So
the Supreme Court would, you know, just kind of vote on whether or not they thought he could continue to serve as governor.
And where does that leave the vacant U.S. Senate seat?
Right now, technically, it's still in the governor's hands until some, you know, legal thing changes either his status in office or the legislature passes legislation to take that decision away from him, which they may do. It seems like from the people I talked to, the most likely scenario at this point is that next week the legislators will pass some law that'll pry that decision out of his hands, use veto-proof majority so that he has nothing to say about it.
And Ben, as Illinois takes all this in and the government tries to do that, what's the mood in the government and the people of Illinois? Does it feel like anyone's in charge or is it just chaos and anarchy?
It's quite a bit of chaos. I think people, you know, I described this to a good friend of mine the other day as it's like a cliffhanger in a movie where you've seen the fire heading towards the fuel tank. So there's both resolution and shock. You know, this has sort of been building up for 5 years, this investigation. But, you know, now that the fuel tank has exploded, people are kind of like, well, we didn't expect it to take out three city blocks. So there's sort of that – both that, you know, this has finally come to a head and also, you know, that people are just kind of caught in disbelief at the scale of the allegations and the nature of the allegations and the tangle that's come afterwards.
Chicago Public Radio political reporter Ben Calhoun. Ben, we'll check in with you when Illinois does something else to grab our attention.
All right. I look forward to it.
One of the charges against Blagojevich, of course, was that he threatened to withhold state assistance on a deal involving the sale of Wrigley Field, which is owned by the Tribune Company. The allegation is that Blagojevich wanted Tribune owners first to fire some members of the Chicago paper's editorial board who had called for his impeachment. But that's not the only reason the company, which also publishes the LA Times and other papers, was in the news this week. They also declared bankruptcy. In light of that and the massive lien the New York Times just leveraged on its own building, the future of daily journalism looks to be on life support. But according to Weekend America's Ben Adair, nothing could be further from the truth. Ben says that reports of newspapers' demise have been greatly exaggerated.
Newspapers have been under siege for a long time. There were the challenges brought by the pamphlet and broadside industries back in the 1700s, later the telegraph and telephone monopolies. Not to mention radio and TV. And now, 50 years later, the internet is finally going to do it, right?
No, it's not true at all.
Myth number one about the current state of newspapers. Newspapers don't make any money.
Through the first 9 months of this year, their average operating profit margin was 11%. I mean, there's some industries that can't ever hope to get that high of a profit margin.
John Morton analyzes the newspaper industry and helps newspaper publishers figure out how to, yes, make money in this new economy.
We only hear about the big city papers generally, you know, the Chicago Tribunes and the LA Times and those. But there are, you know, 1,400 daily newspapers in this country. The average circulation size is about 35,000. And for the most part, particularly smaller newspapers, you know, they're not making as much money as they were, but they're still, you know, doing well.
It's a question of scale. Profits are shrinking, down from 40% margins in some cases to more like 20% or 10%. And there are patterns emerging. Smaller papers are doing better than big ones, generally, and privately held companies are faring better than publicly traded.
The future of newspapers is going to be much less profitable than it has been in the past. And I don't think there's any way of getting around that. Newspaper owners just have to come to grips with it.
Myth number two.
Does Google want to kill all newspapers?
The internet wants newspapers to fail.
No, we don't.
Josh Cohen is responsible for news.google.com, and he says that contrary to popular belief, aggregator sites like his depend on daily newspapers and really want them to succeed and be profitable and to cover their local communities. Because, to be honest, if daily newspapers die, Google News will also die.
Search engines don't create content. It's really about helping people find content. So if there's not great content, whether it's newspapers or other type of content, there's not a whole lot for people to search for.
So Google News has been partnering with daily papers to help them in three specific ways. Number one, distribution. You search Google, you find a relevant article, you click and you go to a newspaper's website, which is basically the internet's way of pitching a paper up on your driveway. Number two, engagement. Google provides technology to newspapers to make their websites and stories much more dynamic, more engaging. A recent example of this is an easily updated Google map that the LA Times put on its own website to keep Angelenos abreast of the latest wildfires. You click the map, you see the ever-changing boundaries of the fire, you see new photos linked to very specific locations, you see where the evacuation sites are located, even get directions to drive there and volunteer. Finally, Google helps papers make money on the internet by brokering both text and display advertisements. It's not the new economic model for daily papers, but it could be part of it.
I mean, more and more people are reading news these days. They're just reading it in a different way. And so increasingly, it's from our side, it's trying to figure out how people can find what they're looking for. And we're able to provide the newspapers with reach that they don't necessarily have on their own.
Which brings us to myth number three. If newspapers are dying, that means journalism is dying.
Journalism is very much still alive.
Neil Henry is the dean of the journalism school at the University of California, Berkeley.
It is, in fact, at the dawn, I think, of a tremendous rebirth.
Henry says, yes, newspaper newsrooms can be very sad and depressing these days, but he tells his students that times of great tumult have always meant really good things for journalism.
You know, I was just thinking earlier today, as we embark on what appears to be one of the greatest and most challenging times since the Great Depression, I was thinking about the works that were done during the Great Depression, the great writers that emerged, the great photo documentarians documenting what was happening to migrant workers, factory workers around the country. It was a time when the value of information in a democracy became clear in a lot of different ways. And I'm thinking that perhaps with the practice of journalism in the digital age, that as we face this great calamity that is before us, maybe journalism will again arise to the level it has in its past, according to those high standards we believe are worth protecting.
Nobody knows the future of newspapers, but one thing is clear. Newspapers, just like the news itself, will be with us for at least the foreseeable future. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Adair for Weekend America.
On Friday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Detroit Free Press is considering cutting back home delivery of its print version to only 3 days a week. That report was in the Wall Street Journal's online edition. The online version of the Free Press is not commenting. Something to think about when, if, however you read your Sunday paper tomorrow.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
A Christmas letter is a nice way to catch up on someone else's family. But what if it changed everything you knew about your own family? Next on Weekend America. It's Week in America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe. We're getting into the thick of the holidays right now, caroling, decorating, shopping, or maybe not so much shopping this year. And then there are the Christmas cards. And with those cards often come the Christmas letters. You know, updates on what the family's doing, what the kids are up to, highlights, lowlights, bragging sometimes. Our next story is about family and a very revealing Christmas letter. Raluca Anchoyu is the director of immigrant services for Catholic Charities in New York City. She and her family are originally from Bucharest, Romania.
My dad, he was in the Romanian army. He was a captain. And he applied to come here as a tourist. And in 81, the Romanian government said, okay, you and your wife can go, but the girl has to stay. That way you'll come back for her.
Nobody. My parents didn't know about my departure. Nobody. Because you have the KGB signature. You go to the airport. You are just about to board. In the meanwhile, someone makes a call.
So, hey, there's a guy who gave them approval to leave. He's not going to come back. What's his name?
They came here as visitors, and they defected.
My ex-wife at the time, she was always crying. We left our daughter there.
So they wrote back.
We made up a story, like, my ex-wife was
pregnant again, but she'd get better medical care here. I was an only child, and I thought, oh, they're going to have a kid over there. Forget it. They're going to leave me here. So I was quite terrified. I was living with my grandparents and my aunts and uncles for about a year and a half before my coming here was approved.
When she came here...
I really resented them when I came here.
I was her...
For about a year.
...worst enemy. For almost 1 year.
We just didn't get along very well. And I didn't really like this country at all.
We barely talked that time. She didn't want to walk next to me on a sidewalk, let's say, in a store.
My dad's always been the military type. He's very dictatorial. I would liken him to Giuliani. He would punish me if I didn't recognize a particular symphony or the composer. And I had to read all these books that he told me to read, and for him to make sure that I read them and understood them, I would have to write a report on them.
I think I was quite severe with her.
In 91, my parents had separated, and around Christmas time, I would come back from Tufts, where I went to undergrad, and we would get Christmas cards from Romania in very stereotypical, chauvinist Romanian fashion. They'd be addressed to my dad, but they'd be for the whole family. So I found a Christmas card addressed to my dad. I opened it, and I remember reading Draga Tata, which means Dear Dad. And I totally freaked out. I ripped it up. I went into this big Tampa tantrum. And then when my dad came home, I said, I have to talk to you. And I said, I found the... There was a card in the mail. It was from your son. I want to tell you that I ripped it up and it's in the garbage.
Her half-brother was a hidden fact. Well, I was the only one knowing about it. Here.
He denied it. He said it. He doesn't know if this is his son or not.
So, Luca, yes, I had an extramarital affair while being married to your mom. And she had a baby. But I'm not 100% that the baby is mine.
And that was... it then. There was nothing else. We didn't talk about it again. Then I heard from my aunt, who went to Romania several times, that she brought him something from my dad and he looks just like my dad. So I knew he was...
I knew the kid was mine. I took care of him the first 3 years. Leave his mother. Leave you is my son. So leave his mother, found a way to sent his picture to me. So immediately I started, I called him. Oh, that was a fantastic call.
I had to sit down the first time when I heard him again. He called, but I don't remember what he said. I just recognized the voice.
I haven't heard my voice for so long, he forgot about my voice. He said, who are you? If you are my dad, stay with me, don't hang up.
He came to Romania and probably we talked more. 97, 98, 99. That's when I found out about my half-sister.
And then my dad had a DNA test done, and then he told me that he has a son. And then a couple of weeks later, he asked me what we can do to bring him over. Me being the immigration expert, I did the papers for him.
My sister told my father, and my father told me that I have, like, only 2 or 3 weeks, otherwise I'll lose my chances to come here. That month, I was becoming 21, and after 21, you have to go through another process.
Since he wasn't a child of a marriage, and since he wasn't legitimated, my father, according to immigration law, he had to prove that he had an ongoing relationship with him over the years of a father and son. He had to submit letters.
I had some pictures with him. Letters.
I wasn't ambivalent about him coming over, and when I agreed to do the papers, I didn't have any, you know, I was grown up or whatever, it didn't really matter. But what hit me the hardest is he had to submit letters, and when I read them is when I really got upset. They were mostly from my dad to him, and he would write these amorphous things to him, and everything's like a metaphor, very poetic. He didn't necessarily write those letters to me until later on in life.
I didn't seriously think about coming here, so I probably didn't realize what I'm starting or what I'm doing until I was already here. It was like a childish thing. Yeah, I'm going to America. Nice, now what?
This is a painful thing to reconsider.
And the kid, I mean, he's great. And he's so sweet. I mean, he's very nice. I didn't think I was going to like him, but...
I hope that she got some good from me because, you know...
I mean, I don't think of him as my brother, but I like him. He's really nice and my husband likes him, so...
Yeah, my new family. Hello. I didn't ask my mother about lots of things. I didn't ask him. I think if they want to tell me, that's fine. If they don't, that's fine again.
Well, it's a very strange story, isn't it?
That story was produced by Judith Sloan with Warren Lehrer. It's part of their multimedia project, Crossing the Boulevard, Strangers, Neighbors, Aliens in a New America. You can find links to that and photos of Raluca, Ian, and Leviu. It's all at weekinamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
Sarah's dad died 18 years ago. Can she reconnect with him by going out in the woods to kill a deer? She tries, ahead on Weekend America. from American Public Media. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, and it's time to listen to your weekend soundtrack. Our latest soundtrack comes from Paula Pisani in San Diego, California, and her soundtrack is Tracy in the Bathroom Killing Thrills by Mary's Danish. Paula, what makes this your weekend soundtrack?
This song is one giant adrenaline rush, which for me is a perfect way to start the weekend. I feel like I spend much of the week in my head being serious at my job, and anytime I can get out of my head and get the blood going and get the adrenaline running, then it's a good weekend.
And what do you do for a job?
I am a copy editor at a daily newspaper.
Okay, not the most visceral experience.
No.
So, besides listening to this song, what are you doing on the weekends to get that blood flowing?
My weekends are actually Tuesday and Wednesday because it's the nature of the job. But on my weekends, I like to go surfing. I always thought that this song would make a great soundtrack to a surf video. I ride my bike a lot. The song plays in my head, and it's gotten me up a lot of impossible hills. I go bungee jumping every once in a while, and it plays there. I like to think that in my head, at least, I'm extreme.
I think so. I'll grant you that.
I spend all week, you know, being somebody's employee, and I'm an editor, so I read a lot of stories about death, destruction, and financial crises. And I have some chronic pain issues, and I really try to work through that and just kind of make up for the week where I've sat at my desk, you know, maybe eating aspirin.
Do you listen to this with other people?
I don't. My husband tolerates my choice in music, but he doesn't really celebrate it with me.
Celebrate,
yeah. Music has always played a starring role in my life. When I was growing up, my mom was a DJ, and she was an audio engineer at a community radio station. And so the radio was just always on, and she never told me to turn the radio down. It was always, oh, turn this up, and who's this, and maybe I'll play it on my program.
Wow, you couldn't shock your mom.
And I tried, I really tried, but no.
It's like a fundamental rite of passage for a teenager.
I missed out. Maybe I'm making up for it now. I'm in my late 30s, and I never thought that I would still be listening to this kind of music in my late 30s. I thought I would be an adult and be grown up and very, I don't know, serious, but that's not how it worked out, and I'm glad.
Paula Pisani of San Diego, thanks.
Thank you. It was nice talking with you.
So that's Paula and her energetic music. I kind of feel like I need to go skateboarding now or something. What about you? What's the soundtrack to your weekend? Maybe something that takes you through this very weekend or something from a memory? I have so many. There's a song by Jonathan Richman called You're Crazy for Taking the Bus. It always takes me back to long ago weekends in Montana with my girlfriend. I still listen to it with her, but she's my wife now. We want to hear your weekend soundtrack. Find the link at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This is the last weekend for deer hunting in Wisconsin. The popularity of hunting has been on the decline in most of the country for at least a decade. It competes with other less demanding weekend activities. And that decline is causing some problems. Fewer hunting licenses sold means less money for state wildlife departments. But some states, including Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and New York, say that this year, 2008, demand for licenses is actually up. The economy's got everybody worried, and a deer or two can provide a lot of meals. And that is something that independent producer Sarah Lemanchik knows very well.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I'm standing in the kitchen of my parents' house. It's 5 a.m., it's 12 degrees, and I'm about to go on my first deer hunt with my dad's best friend and hunting buddy, Bob Sweet. We are going to stop for coffee.
Oh, yes, right? Yes, absolutely.
That's going to happen.
Part of my ritual was donuts.
I always thought that my first hunt would have been with my dad, but for a variety of reasons, it didn't work out that way. Hunting was a way of life in my family for generations. My great-grandfather came from Poland to work in the logging industry and never made quite enough to make ends meet. So the family lived off shooting squirrels, trapping rabbits, and Auntie Kasia's goose blood soup. My dad, Dennis Lemanchik, was the first Lemanchik to graduate from high school and even graduate school. His friend Bob Sweet was a kindred spirit.
Back when I was a young man, I lived in a small town then, but everybody went deer hunting. It was almost a stigma if you didn't go deer hunting.
Bob and my dad moved to the city, Madison, but they never really adjusted. That's why they felt right at home beheading and skinning deer in our suburban front yard. This sort of thing does not happen in town.
But my fingers felt like there were ice cubes on the end of stumps during that process, getting that skin off.
The now headless and skinless carcass was then brought to me so I could pick the gristle off it before it was officially slaughtered, labeled chuck or steak, and tucked away in the basement freezer. Each year, I begged my dad to take me hunting. Each year, he said I had to be 13. By the time I reached that age, I was going to the mall, I was listening to glam rock on my Walkman, I was busy. My dad was diagnosed with colon cancer my junior year of high school. He died when I was 18. Now, at 36, I'm just a few years shy of the age he was when he died. And when I tell my children who we are as a family, there's something missing. I'm out to find my dad in the woods with Bob Sweet.
All right. We are here.
We are here.
We never ate our donuts.
Well, there'll still be time. But I'm wrong. The crisp, clean echo of gunshots are already in the air.
We are here. Well, there are guys that will sit out here the entire day. I mean, they won't leave. They won't leave their spot from 6 o'clock in the morning until 4:30 at night. They'll never leave it. On a good day, I'll usually stay here about 2 hours. Then I'll justify leaving, saying this is not a good spot. But
I could see it being a not so good spot in the not too distant future. We're sitting at the base of a tree, nearly under a deer stand. But Bob is not a deer stand guy. Icy prairie grass and frozen marshland spreads out ahead of us. I'm wearing two pairs of mittens, and Bob's mustache is starting to freeze over.
What they'll do in that high grass, they will get out there and lie down. The deer that have been around for more than 1 year are acutely aware of what these gunshot sounds mean. So they get pretty crafty.
That's wild that they know. I wouldn't have thought they would have known. Mm-hmm.
They're very smart. That's another thing, too, in trying to track deer. I actually have seen deer. I found deer standing behind me. That's happened to me a couple of times. When I was telling you about how they'll track you, did you hear that snort?
I did.
That's a buck. There's a buck around here, and I'm going to put the mic down.
We didn't get him. We didn't even see him. But the finicky deer did give us the chance to talk about my dad. It was the first time we ever had. One of the last things my dad said to me was not to forget him. He was leaving us so young. It was his greatest fear that we wouldn't remember him. At the time, I couldn't imagine a day when his memory wouldn't pierce every moment.
like if we'd had this conversation 15 years ago, you know, like there'd be this time and this time and this time and this time. But now it's just kind of this haze, you know? You know, like I remember dancing with him at your wedding until like him spinning me so fast in the polka that like I couldn't stand afterwards, you know?
The other thing I really remember about him is he had the darndest funny little grin when if something was funny to him. It wasn't, I mean, he didn't do a big belly laugh or anything. He just had this funny little grin. He kind of scrooched his side of his mouth up or something or other and kind of looked like, I don't know why, something really strange. But
I know exactly the smile he was talking about, and it was refreshing to think of him in that way and not the way he was at the end. The night he died, I dragged my baby sister there to say goodbye. She was 9. His eyes wouldn't focus anymore. He couldn't speak. I don't really even know if he knew we were there. It was New Year's Eve, 1990.
You know, when he got sick, it really, really bothered me. And I don't know if you were aware of this or not, but I didn't go see him very much after he was sick. It's like I didn't want to be associated with that, with him being, I didn't want to acknowledge it, and I was stupid of me. And I don't know, to this day, I can't really tell you what it was, but I'd have rather taken a beating.
I hadn't known. It didn't really hurt, but it was all just so sad. For my dad, for Bob, for me. We sat there, his mustache frozen, my hands beyond numb, waiting for dear.
This is about the time when I usually ask myself why I'm sitting out there. This whole thing's stupid.
But then the deer comes, right?
Well, if you follow the script, it does, yes.
They did. 5 of them. Flushed out from another hunter's bullets. Just out of range.
Well, we're going down a little farther, because if there's a buck in there, he's still hanging around back there, or else he's moved over in the other direction.
We follow them across the frozen marsh, through grass as tall as me and taller. It's beautiful. And I can't believe how much I want to find the deer and kill them. This is why you hunt.
Should we curve back that way to see if we can find the ladies?
Yeah, we can do that.
Even with the gun, Bob and I are far outwitted in this cat and mouse game. Us against them. And it's like being out with my dad.
When your dad passed away, I kind of had that thought, like, you know, and I've got a responsibility here. And it was never really, nothing was ever said between us. But I, like you said, I have a kinship to you and Becca. There's something there.
In the car, Bob told me there'd been a hole in his heart because we'd never spoken about my dad. I hadn't realized there'd been one in mine, too. We didn't say much else. We'd been deer hunting. It was almost noon, and it was time for the final ritual.
What do you want to drink?
The Sportsman Bar and Grill was packed.
Lineys.
Lineys? Okay.
Yep.
It is deer hunting, after all. And it is Wisconsin. And we had Packer football to talk about. For Weekend America, I'm Sarah Lemanchik in Partyville, Wisconsin. Cheers.
We have a picture of Bob Sweet and Sarah on our website, as well as an old Lemanchik family photo with the spoils of a hunt. WeekendAmerica.org. . 2008 is winding down, just a couple more weeks to go, and that means 2009 is just around the corner. We're almost done with the aughts, everybody. And we never came up with a better name for this decade than the aughts. Oh well. Our New Year's show is coming up, January 3rd. We want to hear from you about your New Year's resolutions. We've already heard from some listeners through WeekendAmerica.org. Danny plans to give up watching television in 2009. Don't scoff. Danny has a good track record of these things. In years past, he's given up pizza, candy, and in 2008, Xbox. He says he was addicted to that. And he says he's already planning what he's going to do with all his newfound free time. He's going to clean the basement, practice his guitar. He'll miss out on what happens on Lost, of course, but he won't be any more confused than the rest of us will. Debbie plans to pay off all her debt next year. Good luck with that, Debbie. And Tim, who's a high school principal, has a resolution to lose weight, but he's ambitious about it in a principal sort of pulling everybody together kind of way. He's starting a competition with his staff to see who will be the biggest loser in the school in 09. So what's your New Year's resolution? We want to hear about it, and we want to hear about your most ambitious or absurd New Year's resolutions in years past. How did those turn out? It's okay. Mine didn't turn out well either. Let us know. We're at weekinamerica.org. Attention, Californians, if you want to go to the beach, do it soon. An Arctic chill is expected to sweep through next week, bringing freezing temperatures to the deserts and storms to Los Angeles. Here with some weekend weather and fun things to do out in it is Jeannie Yandel.
Southern California is not the most wintry place, but La Cañada Flint Ridge, small town, big name, is celebrating the coldest season during winter weekend. Rainy in 61, also known as springtime weather, to make winter wreaths and listen to holiday carols. As a Chicago native, your winter weekend seems strange and intriguing, La Cañada Flint Ridge. How do you know if it's winter if your face isn't freezing off? Cross-country skiing means falling down a lot, or maybe that's just what it means for me. Nonetheless, Burton, Michigan wants to make cross-country skiing even harder at their full moon night ski. 29 and snowy for skiing, and I'm telling you, lots of falling. Headlamps are suggested, but skis are not provided, which is great because then you can just walk. Walking means less falling. Ugh, I have issues. In many parts of the country, icy roads and unpredictable weather make driving difficult, but not difficult enough, says Elephant Butte, New Mexico, at the Christmas Crawl. 60 degrees and sunny to drive your four-wheeler through an obstacle course of rocks, gutters, and concrete pyramids. After, enjoy a soothing snake wrestling match. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
You hear that music? What is that instrument? It's not a piano. What is that? You've heard it somewhere before, but what? The answers ahead on Weekend America.
Weekend America, supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. It's the holiday season, which means you are hearing this music a lot. But do you know what's making it? It's not a piano. It's not a xylophone. Turns out it's a celesta. And thanks to Tchaikovsky's Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy from the Nutcracker, celesta music has become something of a soundtrack to the season, especially in commercials. You've probably heard it selling cars, kitchen gadgets, computers. Here to help me get this tune out of my head and illuminate the Celesta is the host of Public Radio's Performance Today, Fred Child. Hi, Fred.
John, good to be with you.
Tell me about the Celesta. What is it?
The Celesta, well, if you look at it, it looks kind of like a small upright piano, sort of a little wooden box. It has a keyboard on one side, not as long as a piano keyboard, a little bit shorter than that. But on the inside, instead of hitting strings, the hammers hit these little steel plates, this beautiful, high, clear, penetrating tones. And those vibrating steel plates are what make the sound of the Celesta.
So, Fred, help me get this song out of my head. This can't be all there is to the Celesta.
Well, a couple of decades after Tchaikovsky, Gustav Holst wrote a piece called The Planets. Gustav Holst was not only a great composer, he was a really good astrologer, too. And actually, when you listen to The Planets, it's not about the planets out there in space. It's about the astrological ideas represented by the planets.
About your horoscope?
It's exactly right, yeah. Oh. He was reading a book about how to cast a horoscope when he wrote this music. So Neptune was the furthest out of the planets. So for this faraway celestial sound, which, by the way, is where the name comes from.
Celestial.
Celestial, exactly. This otherworldly sound. He used the Celesta.
Not doing much to carry the melody line, really, is it?
No, it's really just a feeling. I mean, there's a great melody in Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies, but the Celesta is really about that feeling of creating an alternative reality.
It has a very sprightly quality to it, too. It's an alternate reality that's kind of perky.
Alternate realities are sometimes very friendly and benevolent, but sometimes very evil and malevolent. Bela Bartok wrote a piece that actually has Celesta in the title. It's called Music for Strings, Percussion, and Celesta. Does it sound like composers all copy each other when they're writing for Celesta? It's that same kind of just
it's
up in the air feeling.
Up and down kind of
yeah.
thing.
And again, as you said, not melody, right. Just creating a sense of that alternate reality. It's almost like the rules of physics change a little bit when you hear the Celesta.
I'm imagining some fairy dust being sprinkled every time I hear it.
Exactly.
And that notion has been used in contemporary cinema as well.
Yes, and in fact, that very moment that we just heard shows up in several different movies. It's in one of the hippest movies of all time, Being John Malkovich.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
You know, there's a childlike quality to a lot of it, but then, you know, there's an underscoring of peril and danger, which brings us to the Harry Potter film.
John Williams, when he was writing the music for the Harry Potter movies, used the Celesta. And again, it has that childlike sense of wonder, but that undertone of malevolence.
I'm seeing snow falling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Harry's in a world of wonder, but Voldemort's going to try to kill him.
Mm-hmm. There are Quidditch games to come, which could be a lot of fun, but could be really dangerous, too. Yeah.
There'll be hijinks and shenanigans and also evil. We've talked about classical composers. We've talked about film scores. And the Celesta, it's a compelling instrument. It's never going to replace the piano or the guitar. Is it being used in popular music today?
Well, even though the Celesta the sound comes from metal, that vibrating steel, I don't think we'll hear Metallica using it anytime soon. It's not a real...
Sadly.
Yeah, sadly. It's not a real powerful sound, the Celesta. But lots of other folks have discovered this. You hear lots of Celesta in people like Björk and Sigur Rós, bands and artists who specialize in that kind of otherworldly sound. The Eels is a band that loves to use Celesta. It's all over their albums. And it's also in a song by the band Death Cab for Cutie, a song called Title and Registration.
Yeah, celesta solo.
Absolutely, man, that rocks. John, there's one more song I want to share, a classic piece of American music that's so well known, but I don't think people make the celesta connection when they hear this. The song is Every Day by Buddy Holly.
Every day, it's a getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day, it's a getting faster. Everyone said, go ahead and ask her. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey.
Fred Child is the host of Performance Today from American Public Media. Thanks, Fred.
Glad to be with you, John.
A little stronger, come what may. Do you ever long for true love from me? Every day, it's a getting.
We have some wonderful celesta moments on our website. We've got the Eels, we've got Bartok, we have Death Cab for Cutie. If you want to get a close-up look at the instrument in action, we even have pictures of the instrument. It's all at weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of the entire show at weekendamerica.org. You can become a fan of Weekend America on Facebook. Get updates on how you can be a part of future shows. We love to work you into what we're doing here on the air. Just search for Weekend America on Facebook. Become a fan. You'll find us. Get out there and enjoy your weekend.
Love's a little stronger, come what may. Do you ever long for true love?
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
A tale of two dramas. I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, actors face an annual challenge of mentally preparing for a play that never changes.
The role is focused on, from my point of view, on a guy facing his own death. And, you know, as I'm 65 now, so it's a different role than it was when I played it 10 years ago.
Overcoming the ghost of production's past to find something new in a holiday classic. Join us.